Oh, we do. It's really good. Let's see. All right. So I guess my point of view for today is to talk about this fact that we have this conceptually common idea of how dynamos work. You know, there's a kinematic growth phase, and then things go highly nonlinear, and the sink saturate with a Lorentz force, and this is... Who's making all the noise in there? Shall I start again? Should we just assume these people didn't care about the first bit?
I don't care about any of it.
Yeah. All right, so we have this idea about dynamos, right? There's a kinematic growth of an eigenfunction. Eventually this bit gets large enough, the magnetic field reacts back on the flow, Lorentz forces then saturate, change the flow, and everything saturates at some nice nonlinear level, and we have a dynamo. But unfortunately, we do this, we're always, especially in the astrophysics context, want to think that this is a highly turbulent thing. But then whenever we try and do these highly turbulent problems, like drive these things with a sort of natural forcing, like convection or something like that, none of these dynamos seem to work in the sense that they don't produce any large-scale field, any field which is large compared to the scale of the velocity on which things are being driven, which is, of course, one of the things that we want to do. So there seems to be this thing where, like, no matter how hard we try, we push it to more turbulent, we put in more physics, we do this, that, and the other, we can't get some of the simple concepts to work out of these things, like the fully nonlinear concept of an alpha effect. People are kicking themselves in the head trying to make these things work and are not being very successful. They're rotating it like crazy, etc., driving it to very high degrees of turbulence, and you still can't get this thing to produce a large-scale field. So the other thing that we're coming to, some of this conclusion here now, is that, well, if you don't do all that stuff, then you can get some things to work. So you've heard some stuff from Dave Galloway about his Arcontes dynamo. And the thing that I'm going to show you is another occasion where, another example of something where if you don't do something tremendously sophisticated, you still operate in a very much more laminar context, but still it's laminar in the sense that things are smooth and the flows are fairly simple, but it's very highly nonlinear. It's a very complex system that we're dealing with, and the nonlinear interactions are the things which are the most important. Then you can get these things to work. So there's this bizarre sort of, dichotomy between the way you think it should work in this highly complicated sense, and we can't get it to work, and then there's these simple examples of where it does seem to work. So where do we go from here is the question. So anyway, so what I'm going to do is give you an example of this thing. So this is a dynamo without many of the usual ingredients. That's the idea. And this is work that was actually done by a graduate student of mine. I think in my last talk I didn't really mention the fact that Jeff Vassell, a previous graduate student of mine, did all the work here. And this one, Kelly Klein, did all the work, and Fausto and I sort of watched and tried to figure out what was going on with him. So anyway, whoops. So first of all, I'm just going to show you what happens. Here's the dynamo. Hopefully it's going to... Yeah, that's not a very good dynamo.
Enter the box.
Oh, no, there's a dynamo. Let's try again. Come on. It's supposed to start straight away. Oh, there we go. There we go. So I haven't told you what's going on here, but all you should notice now is there's a bunch of purple blobs being generated in a cyclic sort of manner, and that's actually magnetic field of one polarity. This is toroidal field, say. And now there's a bunch of green blobs, which is toroidal field of the other polarity being generated. But, this is a process where, magnetic field, you started off with a black box, which was the initial magnetic field. You couldn't see any magnetic field. And then it went into this mode where it produced a bunch of blobs, and then it produced another bunch of blobs. And if that in itself is kind of cute, but not very convincing that this thing is a dynamo, here's a little bit more of a quantitative measure. So this is a measure of the magnetic field strength, actually, in the toroidal, which is the BX component in this case, against time. And so you see these spikes, which are those blobs emerging. So we started off down here with a field strength of about 1, and you end up with this thing, which is sustaining magnetic field with these spikes at a field strength of about 1500 in some bizarre units. And you can see the spikes here, these dashed ones are a positive toroidal field. And then there's a kind of a reversal, and then I get spikes here dominated by the negative, sorry, the way around. Negative is the dashed, and positive is the line. So you think, well, okay, so I started off, and a diffusion time is about 300 in this thing. So this thing you're looking at here is longer than a diffusion time. And so I have this behavior whereby some sort of strong magnetic field is maintained, and it has this, you know, interesting behavior of a reversal. Well, we can look at that on longer time scale. So like I said, 300 is a diffusion time, so now I'm up to like 8 or more diffusion times. And this thing goes on forever. And this one is particularly interesting, this particular case, which is for very certain, you know, carefully chosen parameters, of course, but it's an interesting example of this thing, you know, has cyclic behavior, then it reverses and has cyclic behavior of the other type for a while, and it reverses, and then it has some periods here where things tend to die away and disappear, and there's a longer period here where things tend to die away, and then it comes back and goes into reversals and stuff like this. So you think, aha, just the type of thing we're looking for. Now, far be it for me to suggest that this is a good model of anything to do with solar things, but it is a good model of a dynamo which has a lot of the characteristics that we're interested in. Okay? So, and it's certainly a dynamo. I mean, I would say anything which has run for 8 diffusion times and still manages to sustain magnetic field at, you know, a good, I mean, a large percentage larger than it started off with is a pretty good dynamo. So I haven't told you what this thing is or where it comes from or anything like that. I've just showed you that it has it is a dynamo of the sort of things that we're interested in. So what the heck is this thing is the question. Well, this is, those of you who saw my other talk, this is the same sort of thing. I had 2 scenarios, and that one's A and B, and I talked about B there. Well, this one is A. Okay, so this is something which is driven by magnetic buoyancy. But the interesting thing is that this thing doesn't have, there's no rotation in this thing. Something which we commonly assume that has to be there to break symmetries to make a dynamo work. No rotation in this thing. And also, there's no turbulence in this thing, really. Okay, as you saw from the movie, this thing is pretty laminar. But, you know, there is a lot of nonlinear reactions, and it's very non-kinematic. So that's the key to how this thing works. So yeah, like I said, it was motivated by this concept of trying to create magnetic buoyantly rising structures out of a shear flow. So that's where this thing comes from. And in this context, what we actually do, it's the same as the previous context that I talked about before, is we have some shear flow and we have some poloidal background field, and we try and create toroidal magnetic field by the stretching action of this localized shear flow. So don't worry about the details too much, but in this case, what I have is a shear flow which depends on Z, which is depth, and in the Y direction. It's hard to wave the thing in that direction. Yeah, there you go, in the Y direction. So it has kind of a cosine profile in the y direction, and it switches on at a certain depth and off further down. So it's only localized to a sort of region in depth, this thing. So it has shear in this direction, and it turns on and off with depth. And so what I do is then put a BY across this direction. So any BY in that direction will get sheared out into the x direction, which is the toroidal direction with time. And in this case, just because I want this thing to sort of be able to judge the dynamo effectiveness of this thing, BY is in one direction in the upper half of the box and the other direction in the lower half of the box. So what this says is, if this thing's not a dynamo, then these two opposite signs of BY are going to cancel out, and all the magnetic field is going to disappear. It's going to run down. Okay? But if it is a dynamo, then you will see magnetic fields sustained. So that's the idea of this thing. So there's a whole bunch of parameters to play here. Well, let's just talk about it in terms of one. What is the initial field strength? So if I give this thing a very weak initial field strength, what I get is just an equilibrium where basically what I said happens. So in this case, we're looking, so the shear goes this way and is on and off with depth. And I'm putting a field which is that way at the bottom, this way at the top. And so what happens is that field does get sheared out and creates a structure. Now the shear in this case, it's kind of like a sawtooth, so it's very strong in the middle. So what I'm doing is creating one very strong central structure of one sign, and then opposite sign structures which are weaker to the left and right of it. It's periodic in the y direction, so you can do that. So for weak initial conditions, for weak initial magnetic field, what happens is it just stretches out in the y direction and creates these structures, and then they just sit there. I could show you a movie of this, but it's like the most boring movie ever. And what you can see is basically all the statistics, they start off, these are really tiny numbers here, so don't worry about this, but you know, everything goes flat lines on us. So what happens if I increase that initial, well, let's just say one thing about this equilibrium first, sorry. So this equilibrium is sustained by the fact that, I'm shearing and I'm pulling out and I'm diffusing to try and remove that magnetic field, but also involved in that little equilibrium is the fact that if I look at this thing in Y, so look down the tube, then that tube has a density deficit due to magnetic buoyancy. This is a compressible calculation in a stable atmosphere. So it has a density deficit, and this thing can drive a poloidal flow. So that's really what buoyancy is, right? Buoyancy is a density deficit which drives a poloidal flow, which tries to lift up the density deficit out of the generating region. But in this case, everything balances. Okay, so I have a poloidal flow, a stretching and inducting, inducing mechanism, and diffusion, and they all balance out. So in that case, if they all balance out, then really what happens, that's not actually a true equilibrium, because what actually happens, the situation is going to run down, like I said, because I have plus and minus in the magnetic field, they're actually gradually going to diffuse and cancel. So you can show that, that over a diffusion time, these things tend to disappear. So how do I get the dynamo? Well, what I do is make the initial field stronger. And if I make the initial field stronger, then what I actually see is I ramp up to an equilibrium, and then it goes unstable to a particular instability. So you can see here is that equilibrium, and then boom, something else happens. And what actually happens is that a Kelvin-Helmholtz, a hydrodynamic Kelvin-Helmholtz instability happens at this point. And that's how you get all the subsequent dynamics, because the Kelvin-Helmholtz takes that tube in the x direction, which is independent of x, and it twists it, and that gives it a poloidal component, and that's what takes toroidal back into poloidal, and therefore completes the dynamo cycle. So it's the appearance of this Kelvin-Helmholtz instability which allows the dynamo to operate, because this is the thing which closes the loop. Now, where does this Kelvin-Helmholtz instability come from? Well, the way it appears is, because I've made the initial field stronger, I'm stretching out a strong toroidal tube, and that strong toroidal tube then actually feeds back on the driving shear flow. So what happens is, because this creates a density deficit, it creates an inward flow towards that tube, and that inward flow advects the shear and steepens the shear. So there's a magnetically induced steepening of the shear which drives the whole dynamics in this thing. And if that tube is strong enough, then it can steepen that shear sufficiently that it goes Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable, produces Kelvin-Helmholtz modes, which do all the twisting and do all the rest of the dynamo loop. So, like I said, we're producing fairly laminar structures here, but look at the complex nonlinear interactions we have to go, the contortions we have to go through to get this thing.
What is strong? What do you call strong? Criteria to initiate
these. You need to create a significant magnetic pressure in here so that there's enough density deficit to drive the flows which move the shear flow around.
Is that
the criteria of the study? No. Not in 20 minutes, no, sorry. I can talk to you about it afterwards in great gory detail if you want. But
your magnetic pressure is comparable to gas pressure, 10-20% or something.
Yes, sure. Yeah, it has to be.
Can you accomplish that with a weaker initial field but a higher Reynolds number?
Yes, there's all kinds of different ways of getting to the same state, right. But yeah, I'm not going to go into all the details right now. This is fairly old work, by the way. This is 5 years old. There's papers on this stuff. You can read all the details of this thing without any problem. So anyway, so that's what I said. So this is what happens. You end up with these kinked tubes above and below, and these are the things which recreate the poloidal field. So here it is again. Let's skip this bit. I already said that in words. We don't need to do that. So like I said, that's what happens. So there's this. Now I have this way of creating a cycle, because what I can do is create a strong toroidal tube. That can react back on the shear. That's a nonlinear process. That thing can go Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable. That's a nonlinear process. That can then twist up these toroidal fields into poloidal fields. And then once I have a poloidal field, I can go around again. Then there's all kinds of complicated dynamics to do with, how do these reversals happen? How do these periods of quiet periods happen, all that sort of stuff. And there's a lot of details on that stuff which I really don't want to discuss. I just want to get this main point about the fact that how this dynamo works across. So, for example, just quickly, reversals, you can see that each time I go through one of these things, it's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And eventually it gets strong enough that it can completely disrupt the background shear flow. And then it has to regenerate itself, and it regenerates itself with the opposite polarity. So there's lots of details in this thing that I'm not going to talk about. Here it is. I'm going to ignore it. So you already saw the movie. So the thing to note that you know, there's no way this thing can be a kinematic dynamo. So this sort of simple notion we have where, you know, I have this kinematic motions and then eventually they grow and eventually the fluctuations get large enough that becomes nonlinear feedback comes into this thing and becomes a big nonlinear problem. No, this can't work. This thing is not kinematic. Can't possibly be kinematic because this thing relies on a sufficient size of the magnetic field to modify the background shear for this thing to work. So there's a critical threshold of the size of the initial magnetic field for this thing to work. And that depends on RM and all kinds of parameters as well. But, you know, there is a critical size. You know, below a critical size, this dynamo will not kick in because it does not alter the background shear enough to steepen it to create these Kelvin-Helmholtz modes, which then go on to create the poloidal field and close the cycle.
But you can remove the initial field and still have the dynamo.
Say that again?
You can remove the initial field and still have the dynamo.
What do you mean, remove the initial field?
Well, you have this imposed B.
Yeah, no, that's there for all time. That's there for all time, and that has to remain.
Remove it.
No.
Is it just an initial field?
It's just an initial field, so if it wasn't a dynamo, it would run down, yeah.
That maintains the field.
No, it's just an initial field, yeah.
It's very weak initially.
And it's very weak initially, yeah. So, I mean, it's like a factor of at least 100 smaller in amplitude intensity than the field you generate.
This initial field can decay.
Yes, it's plus or minus, so that's the idea. So, I mean, if there's any field there left at all, it has to be a dynamo, otherwise it would just decay. Okay, yeah, and once again, you can play around with the parameters to get various things. One of the interesting things is that, you know, I can make even more bizarre things. So this one's even more bizarre. So this one operates on exactly the same principle. This one's at lower RM, so it's more diffuse. This one just sits there. It doesn't even rise. So in other words, you know, diffusion is acting fast enough that you know, the magnetic field is getting modified in the region of shear. It doesn't have to go out of the region of shear before it gets modified by diffusion. So this one creates steady Kelvin-Helmholtz waves by just sitting in place. And you get this dynamo like this. You can see here's the properties again over here. So here's B, so it jumps up to some value 20 when the initial was down, you know, below 1. And it just sustains it with a slight modulation over time. Everything looks pretty steady. Let's just run that again. If I can. There we go. So you can see that, you know, once again, the Kelvin-Helmholtz has acted, and that's the twist. But then this thing is just a wave. It just kind of twists around. So here's a great example of a dynamo wave. But notice, I mean, there's no way you could call this thing turbulent, right? Not turbulent at all. But on the other hand, there's very complicated nonlinear dynamics which has made this thing happen. The instability happens because of all these strange nonlinear dynamics. So, well, one of the reasons we did this is like to try and figure out what the role of magnetic buoyancy in solar dynamos is. Because you have this sort of concept in your head. What does magnetic buoyancy really do? Because, you know, I'm going to stretch out this magnetic field. If I keep stretching it out, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and sort of gets the intensity gets as large as you want. So is the role of magnetic buoyancy to say, okay, when it gets to a certain size, then I'm going to remove it from the generation region. And so magnetic buoyancy plays this limiting role. It sort of sets the amplitude that the magnetic field can get to. Or is it, as we've seen in this case, where magnetic buoyancy is actually the cause for closing the dynamo loop? So here, if it wasn't for magnetic buoyancy, you would not be able to get any poloidal dynamics out of this thing. So in this case, magnetic buoyancy is actually the driver of this thing. So this question about... So the first case where magnetic buoyancy is kind of a limiter, I mean, it means that, you know, the dynamo operates in spite of magnetic buoyancy. In the second case, the dynamo is operating because of magnetic buoyancy. The magnetic buoyancy is actually the driving case. And so in this case, what we have is, you know, this type of dynamo is a new class of dynamos in a sense, we think, which is driven solely by the action of magnetic buoyancy. So this one's really driven by magnetic buoyancy. It's all fully self-conditioned, consistent. There's no Coriolis forces. These are the things to notice in this thing. And it's intrinsically very, very highly nonlinear, as I keep emphasizing. So if someone says to you, oh, this is twist, you know, what's the alpha effect? Measure the alpha effect. Tell me the alpha effect. It's a stupid thing to do in this case, right? Because this thing, I mean, there's no linear correlation between EMF and things in here. You know, this is a highly nonlinear situation where it wouldn't make any sense. So this is a very, very non-turbulent dynamo. Perfect. I've got like one sentence to say. These things burn. No. So this is a very, very non-turbulent dynamo, and so that's the thing. So now the big question is, and this is the thing we're trying to address next, is, well, can this thing operate in spite of turbulence? So if I put turbulence on top of this thing, will it still work as a dynamo? So we're now working on sort of, actually we're doing it the cheaty, easy way to start with. We're adding noise to this problem and seeing if it'll still work in the face of noise. Because you think, well, I don't know, what's turbulence going to do to this thing? Well, maybe it gives it an enhanced diffusivity and makes it run better. Or maybe it decorrelates everything and makes it run worse. Who knows? So, you know, this is the point of this talk is, maybe there's all this new class of dynamos where things are extremely laminar, although, so large scale and laminar structures and flows, even though they rely on highly complicated non-linear interactions to be able to generate these things. And then you say, well, okay, if I have these things, can I make them work even though there's turbulence around? So these are non-turbulently driven things. Can they work in spite of turbulence or in the presence of turbulence? And that's, I guess, the basis for all this type of work. So it's a new light on old work, I guess. And I'm done.
If you have two effects, a buoyancy pops up your tube, mm-hmm. at the same time you needed to change the flow. What is the criteria? May it pop up before you reach the dynamo, or you reach first the strong limit to drive dynamo, and then it will pop up. Did you compare this for two effects contradictory to each other?
I mean, you need to be able to create a magnetic field by the stretching mechanism of sufficient amplitude that it reacts back on the shear.
But if it goes up, you don't have a chance to create.
Yeah, right. So there's all kinds of timescales of this thing. I mean, if this thing goes magnetic buoyant before it has time to steepen the shear, then you're not going to get a dynamo. You're just going to get rising structures.
Yeah, we have.
I mean, all these cases exist. I mean, I can give you the paper. You can see ones which are dynamos, not ones which are intermittent dynamos, ones which are chaotic dynamos. There's a million different regimes you can go into, yeah. And I mean, I can give you the paper, which has like a great gory details on all of them.
Yeah, it might be interesting to try and work out the degree of alignment in these.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. Well, I think that's the point, actually, is that the way all these crazy dynamos work is they create exactly the right, the magnetic field mitigates the system so that it creates exactly the right flow that it needs. Yeah. So in this case, mine creates exactly the right Kelvin-Helmholtz, or Kelly's, creates exactly the right Kelvin-Helmholtz flows that it needs, whereas your case, it changes all the flows, everything's aligned.
Yeah. But I mean,
there's a lot of alignment in this one, for sure.
I mean, why don't you calculate, say, local values of mod U, mod B, of mod of U dot B over mod U, mod B. Why don't you calculate the global values of the unsigned quantity and just see how they evolve in time and see whether...
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Large regions of the flow where U and B are either parallel or anti-parallel.
Yeah, it's a good idea. No, I would
track down where they are because you might,
I would bet there's large reasons where everything is parallel because the main shear flow is going this direction. The Kelvin-Helmholtz mode, it's just advecting this magnetic thing around. So yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised.
It's essentially a slow process. This because of the cross-solicity being an invariant of ideal MHD. You have to wait a long time. It would be interesting to see how long you do.
And we can do it over time. And some of these are run for, as you saw, a really, really long time. So we could definitely do that. It's a good idea.
Absolutely.
You have quasi-buoyancy instability, but you might also mention Kelvin-Helmholtz. Mm-hmm. Are the two really, is Kelvin-Helmholtz really critical and important and present?
In this thing?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, you.
So it's actually both, buoyancy instability and Kelvin-Helmholtz, or do you think...
I mean, the Kelvin-Helmholtz is driven by the buoyancy. It's only I start off with a certain shear. It's only because magnetic buoyancy appears that it steepens the shear. I mean, this shear is hydrodynamically stable to Kelvin-Helmholtz instability to start with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's only the fact that it's trying to generate this magnetic field which steepens the shear. And then you can look at the hydrodynamic modes and you can see that it's gone very clearly to a Kelvin-Helmholtz mode in two dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can look at the flow and it's very hydrodynamically Kelvin-Helmholtz, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is quite natural.
Yeah, I mean, the shear just gets steep, that's all. I mean, the magnetic field steepens the shear and it just goes unstable. I mean, you can look at the InVisig criteria and check that it's unstable in that sense as well, but I'm sure it helps you out.
So in dynamo models, one of the big challenges is how do you get super equipartition fields in
right.
Taka Klein? And the way most people do it is to separate the poloidal and toroidal source regions.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what you have here. Do you generate super?
No, this goes into equipartition with a shear. It's not super equipartition. We haven't found a parameter regime where it's super equipartition. I mean, it's just extracting all its energy from the shear, this thing.
Why do you need super equipartition?
Well, because if you look at sunspots are 3,000 Gauss, and if they rise from the base of the convection zone, they
yeah, must be I know that strong. Argument, but you can do it on the way up, can't you? If you evacuate the tubes on the way up, fairly near the bottom,
yeah.
Of the convection zone, you can get away with field strengths, I think, which are lower. Well,
that's the only way of getting super.
It's insufficient, babe. You still need 10 to the 5 Gauss with all these effects at the bottom.
You can have it at the bottom, but once the instant magnetic buoyancy and stability goes off, you can still have it. I mean, I'd expect this evacuation process.
Okay, let's thank Nick again.
Oh, yeah. There's your plug.
It's coming in at number 2, Vexel.
Dynamos driven by magnetic instabilities is the topic of today's session. And we heard already about one example where we have the magnetic buoyancy instability and, of course, as we just heard, the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability as being agents that drive flow that is then suitable for dynamo action. One of the reasons why instabilities as the cause of dynamo action are being thought to be interesting is because one naively thinks, one may really think that these are much more powerful mechanisms of generating magnetic fields, as opposed, and as alluded to by Nick earlier today, as opposed to these usual kinematic dynamos where you have a flow which is driven by some completely different instabilities which are non-magnetic. So in this case, the actual source of the flow is the magnetic field itself, which then of course has to be produced by this by a dynamo, which is the source of the, which is due to this flow, which is generated by the instability. So it's a double positive feedback. However, whether it's really more powerful in the sense of catastrophic quenching is a different story. I had made this point on a few occasions, and I won't do it today, but I will simply say that any such dynamo has to fight against various conservation laws that may be present in such a system. It is well possible that the various dynamos that we have, and we know of many dynamos that all produce magnetic helicity, and magnetic helicity is an invariant quantity, just like the cross helicity as well, which David mentioned a few minutes ago. In the case that I will present, which has to do with the magnetorotational instability, there is actually a history of having measured an alpha effect, and the alpha effect turns out to have an unconventional sign. It's a negative sign, and one of the questions is, why is that the case? So magnetorotational instability, as I said, is a doubly positive feedback. We need a certain magnetic field to get the instability going. In the olden days, we called it the bulbous Hall instability. Now it's often called the magnetorotational instability. These are the same things. They drive flows, and these flows very easily become turbulent because the Reynolds numbers are large. And because of the presence of shear and rotation and other ingredients, like stratification in some cases, you can have a dynamo effect which may or may not cooperate with this instability. So you have to make sure that the MRI, the magnetorotation instability, is cooperating with the dynamo instability to produce a doubly positive feedback. Here is shown an example without stratification. In the absence of stratification, there cannot be an alpha effect. And indeed, we do not see large-scale magnetic fields here. Let me just run this thing again. This is how it looks like in a 512 cubed simulation. No large-scale fields, but one also has to watch in those cases. The runtime is typically not really long enough to be really absolutely sure whether a large-scale magnetic field could be generated on a longer time scale. These runs, in the absence of stratification, tend to produce magnetic power, which is dominant at small length scales. Here's shown a power spectrum as a function of time. Red is the magnetic energy, and black is the kinetic energy. So they have unconventional spectra, which I don't understand as yet. But they are peaked at small scales. And that's in the absence of stratification. In the presence of stratification, here the old run, done some 13 years ago, did show a magnetic field which was of relatively large scale. And what is shown here is an averaged magnetic field. This magnetic field is averaged over, and this is a shearing box simulation, it's averaged over the two horizontal directions, the streamwise direction, which is periodic, and the cross-stream direction, which is shearing periodic. So it's also conservative in that sense, and it makes sense to average over these two directions. The result is then a function of height and time. Here is the midplane. Gravity is zero in the midplane. Gravity pushes downwards from above the midplane and towards the midplane from both ends. What we see here is, in contours, a positive averaged field. Sometime later in orbits here, 30 orbits later, the magnetic field again is strong, but of the opposite direction. The vertical boundary conditions in this case are horizontal field conditions, and they permit the net horizontal flux to change. And again, this looks like a quasi-periodic or oscillatory process. In addition, there is something which looks like a migration away from the midplane. So at heights away from the midplane, the same structure seems to have occurred at a later time, which suggests something like a migration, as we know, of course, from the solar magnetic field, which also shows migration. With the dynamo background in mind, one is tempted to interpret such things in terms of dynamo waves. Other people have, in the meantime, recovered similar results. Omar Blaise, for example, here from Santa Barbara, has new high-resolution simulations with radiation and a number of other physical features in it. They also show migration and oscillatory behavior. The other alternative that they propose in that case is not to invoke mean field dynamo theory, which could readily explain this, but to invoke magnetic buoyancy. So clearly you would expect if magnetic buoyancy releases large-scale magnetic structures, they would also migrate. However, if you want to identify magnetic buoyancy operating locally in these simulations, that's a very tough thing to do, because you have very small structures, and the vertical motion does not normally correlate well with the strength of the magnetic field. So it's very difficult to verify magnetic buoyancy. This is hard to see here on the right-hand side. I just wanted to make the point that if you change the boundary condition from a vertical field condition to a perfect conductor boundary condition, you obtain non-oscillatory solutions, and they are anti-symmetric, as they have to be, because they have to have net toroidal flux in this case. This can be understood in terms of a mean field dynamo theory where you simply change, of course, the boundary conditions from a vertical field condition to a perfect conductor boundary condition, you change the corresponding eigenvalues. Unfortunately, this plot is not good enough to don't let me go into these details. Because these results were relatively old, and I have in the meantime reproduced these results at higher resolution with a different numerical code, and by and large, I obtain the same behavior here. The oscillation times are again on the order of something like 30 orbits. Sometimes it's a bit longer, sometimes it's shorter. And in this case, we have also explored yet another much more realistic boundary condition, which is the potential field boundary condition. So again, we find these oscillations here. I did already say that these simulations, because they do generate a mean magnetic field, as defined by horizontal averages, one naturally wants to ask the question, can this be explained in terms of a mean field dynamo? If one does have a mean magnetic field, why is not a mean field dynamo at work here? And indeed, using modern methods like the test field method, it's possible to calculate all components of the tensor that connects the electromotive force U cross B averaged for the fluctuations in terms of the mean magnetic field and the mean current density. What is shown here is as a function of height in units of scale heights above and below the midplane, the four different components of the alpha tensor. Here is the XX component, here is the YY component, XY and YX components. The toroidal magnetic field, of course, acts on the YY component of the alpha effect. And what we see here is that above the midplane, again, alpha is negative. But it does change sign much further away from the midplane again. By and large, this is a result which is compatible with similar results that have been obtained in the past. Already back in 95, we estimated alpha by simply correlating the U cross B during the simulation with the actual mean magnetic field that is generated. And we found a negative correlation in the northern hemisphere and a positive correlation in the southern hemisphere. So negative alpha effect in the north, positive in the south. Compatible with this result here. Here's another result where again we see a correlation between the mean magnetic field at any given time during the run. Every time step certain time steps correspond to dots, and they produce a scatter plot, which corresponds to a correlation. But this is the electromotive force, which does correlate in a negative sense for modestly strong magnetic fields with the mean magnetic field, up to equipartition values plus and minus. For stronger mean magnetic fields, there seems to be some quenching, as is clearly seen by this curve no longer being linear. So this negative result for alpha is very well established by a number of different simulations. This test field method also gives us now for the first time a handle on the actual turbulent magnetic diffusivity, XX component, YY component. The two horizontal components are the same in magnitude, and they are finite, and they're also positive. This is something which we expect, but it has been extremely hard to compute and obtain with any other method than this test field method. So the test field method is a highly reliable method giving accurate results for such a system, which can be applied both to the kinematic stage, but also to a magnetic system where the flow is already subject to the Lorentz force and therefore nonlinear saturated. Why do we have a negative alpha? There's a simple-minded motivation which I came up with some 10 years ago. Let me briefly run you through the argument. If you use the tau approximation, you would calculate the time derivative of the mean electromotive force. The electromotive force is U cross B. Taking the time derivative gives you a U dot cross B and, of course, a U cross B dot. As is typical for magnetically driven instabilities, the Lorentz force is important. And the Lorentz force enters in the evolution equation for U dot, for the velocity. The governing term that I think is here critical is the magnetic buoyancy term. which is of course proportional to gravity, and the density, local density deficiency, which leads to Archimedean buoyancy. The Archimedean buoyancy again is related to the magnetic field strength. So if the fluctuation in the magnetic field is comparable to the gas pressure, you do generate a buoyancy deficiency. There's a minus sign in between. We think that the important component here is a toroidal magnetic field, so let's linearize this, and we obtain twice By averaged times the By fluctuation. So let's insert this in here and average. Then we obtain, first of all, the By component here. This is the By component from the fluctuation. Here is the average. And we obtain only one component, which enters then in the Y component of the electromotive force by having the cross product for the vertical Z velocity and the X component of the magnetic field. That gives us a toroidal direction. So we have naturally the correlation between By and Bx being the driver of the electromotive force. But moreover, this electromotive force points in the Y direction, and it depends on the magnetic field in the Y direction. So we have immediately the YY component of the alpha tensor in here. To get from such an evolution equation to the alpha equation, of course, one has to do something about the triple correlations. The triple correlations are assumed to be equal to the mean electromotive force divided by some timescale tau. So you write EMF divided by tau, neglect the time derivative, and solve for the EMF, which then becomes equal to this times tau. And that's what we have here. The coefficient in between is called alpha. So there's now tau times g times our buoyancy term, and that's our alpha effect, magnetic alpha effect. In accretion disks, of course, everybody knows about yet another alpha. It has nothing to do with dynamo alphas. It's called the Shakur-Sunyaev alpha. And what that means is an abbreviation for exactly this term, this complete coincidence. What generates, of course, accretion, mass flow inwards, moment and angular momentum flow outwards, is both Reynolds stresses and Maxwell stresses. But the Maxwell stresses are much more important in magnetically driven instabilities. And so it's this Maxwell stress, which we know is negative, of course, because of negative shear, which generates us a positive stress. And so this negative Maxwell stress is called alpha Shakur-Sunyaev. This is non-dimensional, and so is this quantity here, unlike the alpha effect, which, of course, has a dimension of a velocity field. So then it turns out that our alpha effect is actually equal to minus the Shakur-Sunyaev alpha, multiplied by some inverse Rossby number, which is generated by taking this tau together with an angular velocity omega. Omega pops up because gravity in an accretion disk is proportional to the z direction. It's zero in the midplane and positive and negative above and below. So gravity is equal to omega squared times z. One of these omegas enters in here. The other omega enters by defining a sound speed, which is equal to omega times the scale height. And so then our velocity, our alpha, which has to have the dimension of a velocity, is proportional to the sound speed multiplied by z over h. And so it changes, obviously, sign about the equator, and is negative in the northern hemisphere. So that is a simple-minded explanation why the alpha effect here should be negative. So let me remind you, the important ingredients here are simply just stratification and shear. No rotation. So that's different from standard alpha effects.
So what you're saying is Shakur effect is refers to mechanical angular momentum, and you're saying the electrical alpha will be in opposite direction.
Yes, but these two things are simply called alpha for because they are the first letter in the alphabet. That's so you shouldn't think of the alphas being otherwise connected.
I'm trying to make physical sense because I share a room with Shakur when he wrote this formula, and he was talking about transferable angular momentum.
Yeah, yeah, Maxwell stress, Reynolds stress. Yes.
He is in electrical sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Opposite direction.
Yes, 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 yes. Yes, that's obvious, right? So this is of course what enters in the momentum equation for driving material inwards. Yes.
I mean, in a related question, in the sense that the alpha Shakur-Sunyaev is really
in the sense of rescale turbulent viscosity. So you, I mean, what you would expect and what I think in many cases is required for stationary accretion is a fixed relation between the fluid viscosity or the turbulent resistivity. Have you looked into that at all?
Yeah, I think what you want to say is that one should establish that whatever causes the stress is actually related to the angular velocity gradient, the large scale velocity gradient.
I'm saying more than that. In other words, I think you have to be careful that to avoid accreting the field, as it were. You need a turbulent resistivity and conditions of stationarity on a macroscopic level force some relation of that to the turbulent viscosity, which is the alpha Shakura Semyonov.
Yeah, I understand.
It would be interesting to look at the relation between alpha SS and eta T as well as the alpha EMF.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that should be looked at much more carefully, of course, both using simple-minded arguments and pictures like these here, but also, of course, directly measuring this from simulations. And only then one has something which I would really trust. Because, of course, there are non-dimensional quantities which we don't really know how big they are. I mean, if I write inverse Rossby number here, it may be a quantity that is actually much, much smaller than you would naively think, because there's other deficiency or correlations entering which are not taken into account. So it's important to measure then the viscosity, the actual viscosity, which is a function not just of Reynolds stresses as they usually are, but of Maxwell stresses here. We are hoping to do that.
By a similar argument, isn't there an alpha XY which is larger, and wouldn't that explain the rising of the toroidal field?
Yeah, absolutely, you're right. Yes.
Dynamo wave based on an
ICP. So alpha XY, of course, or YX, either of the two components, are certainly there, as you see. And one of the components corresponds to a gamma effect, a positive gamma effect away from the midplane. So gamma effect means, again, it's something with a unit of a velocity field, and it actually plays a role of a velocity, unlike the alpha effect, and it therefore leads to advection of mean magnetic field. And so in this case, we find that the mean toroidal magnetic field is advected away from the midplane by this effect, but the mean radial field is actually advected towards the midplane. That's because the signs are here the same. They should normally be opposite, because it's the antisymmetric part which corresponds to a positive gamma effect. So here the XX component plays place in the opposite sense. And that's not unheard of. We had the similar results over the last two decades. Kichatinov found it first for the sun. Colloidal and toroidal magnetic fields are advected in the opposite sense by the gamma effect, and Ossendriver has verified this, and these simulations also show that. So that's turbulent pumping, that's what it's called. So
does that mean that the reason that the toroidal field rises is more to do with a direct action of magnetic buoyancy rather than the dynamo wave?
I don't think you get a dynamo wave as such, or something which propagates just by buoyancy, by this gamma effect alone. But certainly the gamma effect will modify and perhaps more overemphasize this effect. So you have both, certainly even without a gamma effect you get the migration, and I think with just gamma effect you wouldn't get migration. And quantitatively it matches actually with the propagation speed. I mean, the speed of the wave is equal to the turbulent diffusivity, which we have measured, multiplied by the vertical wave number. That gives you a wave speed, and that actually agrees already. And of course, there will be quantitative issues, will be modified, like because of this gamma tensor, gamma effect.
Guess we're into questions. Have you finished, Axel?
Mm-hmm. I have finished. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Your talk raised a question of terminology. Mm-hmm. This session about instability. Mm-hmm. But if you forget linear stage when instabilities could be classified and go with real nonlinear stage, they look like turbulence. Mm-hmm. So, and then you prove it.
You
generate dynamo, whatever, by image turbulence. Uh-huh. So do we need this term instabilities, to what extent?
Yeah.
We insist on that, but just
to I don't actually insist on this. Obviously, it was critical in understanding this negative sign. So there, it was critical to look at this particular effect, which has to do with buoyancy here. It's different from an ordinary forcing, of course. But I don't otherwise see any differences as such between this system, which is a turbulent one, and a kinematic dynamo. They are similar in the nonlinear stage.
Remember, Clemore and myself were involved. We calculated alpha and MHD turbulence, and it involves B, Y, B, X.
Yeah.
In general sense.
J dot B, you mean?
Oh, without, what
do you mean?
You know, classification.
Yes, and you're talking about this J dot B contribution to the tensor, which is... Yes.
Alpha generated by magnetic small fluctuations.
Yes. One wonders whether this J dot B contribution, in some sense this is of course something like a J dot B, but it would not pop up on its own unless it's actually driven by a specific mechanism in the momentum equation.
And
that's the buoyancy here, yes.
Yeah, I agree.
But otherwise, of course, it's the same term of these two terms which end in here, which also brings in this J dot B, which normally, of course, acts as something which quenches the alpha effect. So in this case, it actually drives.
Yes. Okay, let's thank Axel again. Rattling along nicely, so time for one more talk before coffee. Lara is going to continue our discussion with the MRI, and we'll have coffee, and then we'll have Francois.
With alpha or without alpha?
Well, we just unified the alpha to the next.
Well, for those of you that don't know me too well, I actually started my research career, I should say. What's on there? Working on problems related to solar physics in a mathematics department at Leeds. And about 2.5 years ago, I found myself working in France in a radio astronomy lab for somebody that works largely or principally on accretion disk physics. So what I wanted to share with you today is just a little bit about what I learnt while I was working in Paris. Hopefully this is going to be an honest, there's nothing up my sleeves accounting of what's gone on. We're going to revisit some old territory of calculations that were done in the 90s, extending them with the new computing power, and hopefully you might learn a little something new. So, the MRI, I was told that you had a long discussion on this a few weeks back with a very active discussion session. But the instability was first mentioned in the 1950s, or I think the first count is by Velikov. But in the early 1990s, it went through a kind of rejuvenation phase, I guess, following a series of papers by Balbus, Hawley, and his collaborators. And there's a lot of things that you might want to know about accretion disks. But one of the things, as Axel just alluded to, that comes up quite often is what is going on with this parameter alpha that was originally first mentioned by Shikura and Sunyaev in 1973. So this is going to be the alpha that Axel mentioned near the end of his talk, not the one he was talking about earlier on. So it's not the dynamo alpha. Now, when you're wanting to work out what this turbulent parameter is, you could try and calculate full disk simulations. However, they're incredibly expensive, as anybody that does global simulations will know. Plus, there are many issues concerning what exactly do you take as for the choice of boundary conditions in the problem. So the first approach, and actually one that has survived going through in various iterations with different ingredients added, is this local shearing box model, which I believe, Axel, this is what you're using. Essentially, you have a series of boxes. So this is a periodic square biscuit tin like you would have in the sun. But the boxes on either side slide past each other. So it's periodic in this Y direction, periodic in the Z direction, and in this direction is what you call shearing periodic. Every, box length. So if this was 2 pi, every 2 pi, these boxes would fully line back up with each other. I don't want to go too much into the numerical details. You could see any of Jim Stone's papers on this, because I'm actually going to use the publicly available code Zeus for this work, just to link in with the old calculations. But just to point out one thing that I'll get to in a minute, this is an important factor. This is your periodic computational domain, and in order to work out gradients, you're going to need ghost cells. And when you've got this shearing periodic coordinate system, you actually have to take your interior values and remap them to get your new ghost zones. So there's some interpolation that's going on in order to get your new values for your new ghost zones. So there is a small error there. You're hoping that it's small, and you hope that it's actually going to remain centered on zero. So when I first started reading the literature on the MRI, I went in with the training and the thoughts that I had in solar physics, and I discovered that the approaches in of those who work in accretion disks is somewhat different to what I was used to. Quite often, you'd find that they were working without official, without proper dissipation coefficients, so they'll be using ideal MHD systems. So that was one thing that struck me as completely different to what I was used to. Second, they wanted to calculate this turbulent quantity, this alpha, as in Shukurai and Sunyaev language. But I pulled this paper out the other day from Hawley, Gammy and Balbus, and what you can see is the number of orbits that they run to is pretty small. Obviously, the computational power in the mid-90s wasn't what we have now. And so they're trying to average this parameter alpha over a very few number of orbits. And it's a statistical quantity. I wanted to make sure that if you took a different part of the parameter space, so if you took the first 3 orbits of your statistically steady state, would it be the same as if you took 3 orbits and averaged alpha over it later on? And with 3 orbits, it's actually quite a short time span. And so you did actually get quite a lot of variation in what you get for alpha. These 2 columns at the end here couple together to give us our alpha. The second thing I noticed was traditionally in this local shearing box approximation, you're relying on grid dissipation, or at best an artificial viscosity. You have no real dissipation. And if you look at the computational domain that they have a 1 to 2 pi to 1 ratio, but the actual grid resolution, they only have a factor of 2 greater here than they do here. And they have a 2 pi greater box length. So what they're actually going to get is numerically a difference in their dissipation. Now, why they took this was because in an accretion disk, you expect longer structures in the Y direction, so going along our box or round our disk, than you do widthways. But it's introducing an anisotropy in the diffusion in the problem. So what I wanted to do was do some calculations going back to the old language of ideal MHD. I want to try and see if we can get exactly what alpha is in the sense of searching for a scaling of alpha with dissipation length, if you will accept that increasing resolution in this problem will give you an increase in a decrease in dissipation length. And I also wanted to square off this dissipation so that we've got dissipation that's equal in both directions. So as I say, this is back to old territory. I would normally work, as most of us do in solar physics, with official viscosity, resistivity, conductivity. However, in what I'm about to talk to you about right now, I'm not even going to have an artificial viscosity in there. It turns out you don't need it. I did the calculations with it, with the artificial viscosity that comes part of the package of Zeus, and you get exactly the same results. So just to rule that one out, you don't actually need the artificial viscosity to get exactly the same answer in this. It just doesn't get triggered. And if anybody wants to know what happens if you vary viscosity or resistivity, then I refer you to two papers here, one by Lesure and Longarity, who look at incompressible simulations, and Fromag, Papaloisou, and collaborators, who look at zero mean magnetic fields.
Sorry, Laura, what do you mean by artificial viscosity?
They actually have a trigger. It's just to avoid shocks. So it just gets, when you've got converging flows, it just gets triggered. The one in Zeus, I'm not convinced it's rotationally invariant. Well, that's a conclusion Steve and I came to. So
the curl of the divergence of the stress term, that's fine. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Okay, so the equation said I wanted to try and reduce the problem as far as possible so that hopefully we can drive down the dissipation scales as far as possible and get alpha over some scaling range. So these are the traditional equations that you see floating around in the accretion disk simulations. I'm not going to dwell on this too long. I'll just say that I made even the further simplification than what was done before of having an isothermal equation of state. Q is, in disk language, it's 3 over 2 for a Keplerian disk. So it's minus d log omega by d log r, where omega is the angular velocity. Yeah, that's a Shearton. The basic benchmark cases in this, plasma beta is usually used at about 800. It was varied in the early days. But I wanted to keep that fixed here. We're going to use an initial uniform magnetic field, and as I say, I want to try and square off the grid, and so I'm going to start with a box ratio of 1 by 1. However, because I come from the solar community where if you take small biscuit tins for your convection, you actually get a much different different pattern, I'll elongate this later because one of the things I wanted to do was to explore how elongating this box in the y direction actually affects things. So, yeah, this resolution looks a little laughable, but it's where they started off back in 1990, so I started with this. And here is magnetic energy, on the right, kinetic energy. And as you can see, it tends to grow. And you'd pretty much convince yourself that that's evolved to a statistically steady state. It's flattened off. However, what surprised Steve and I was we wanted to actually calculate alpha. And so we worked out that we'd need more than these 50 orbits here to get what we thought was a converged alpha. So we wanted to run it on further. And when we did this, using Zeus with its Shearing box coordinates, you get this. So our 50 orbits is about here. So this is magnetic energy and this is kinetic energy. So it lulls you into false sense of security that you've got to a statistically steady state. And this is what happens to alpha. It initially looks like it's saturated and then it goes up and blows up on you. Yep?
Sorry, Laura, you showed on the previous figure that the magnetic pressure was exceeding the gas pressure.
Yes. Yeah.
It's terribly fluctuating.
It's terribly fluctuating.
All the way. Where do you get the imaginary part?
I'm going to explain what's going on here and that this is not quite the right answer in a second. Okay. The problem is that this... We did think this was kind of interesting, even though Gordon's comment is valid, on the grounds that we have a shift in what we thought to be an accretion rate. And I was told by observers that you can see, for disk physics, a shift in the spectra, and that would correspond to a shift in the accretion rate. And so we thought maybe if we get to the bottom of this, we'll actually understand it. And I can skip over these. These are just snapshots of if you zoom in on those. And you can see you go from a turbulent or fairly turbulent state for a 1 by 1 box to a more elongated state. Now, I won't go into the details on that, but basically what you're getting in the later stages is a repeated channel solution. All the details of that are in the paper. But what it turns out is the behaviour that we see is fully explained by what occurs to the various mean components. Bx and B, yes, right. Bx and By are initially zero, so they should stay zero, or it's a numerical error. What you're actually getting is this error from the boundary conditions coming up and biting you on long timescales. So when you run on for 1,000 orbits, this error that I mentioned earlier from this interpolation by the boundaries actually doesn't do what it's supposed to do or what you'd like it to, which is be even around zero, but it actually compounds. You get a compound rounding error that actually takes By to be greater than the initial vertical field you started with. So you have a switch in the orientation of the dominant mean magnetic field. Now, the error in these boundary conditions was actually commented on in the 1990s when John Hawley started using Zeus for these calculations. But if you only look over these initial 10 orbits, you actually get a very, very small error. But if you look on the longer time scales, the error actually compounds in order to give you this flick in magnetic field. So maybe, well, one conjecture off this, we haven't gone into checking it yet, is maybe if you switch the balance between the By and BZ fields, you might get this switch in accretion rates that is, as I'm told, are seen in some disks. But that wasn't principally what we were trying to investigate here. We wanted to investigate what happens to alpha as you decrease the dissipation scale and as you increase the box length. Okay, so we did a crude thing of correcting this error by cleaning it out every so often. There's multiple ways you can get rid of this build-up. What we did was play around with it and remove the mean every 100 or so time steps as an initial approximation. You can work with different things. I'm told by Geoffroy that if you use shearing coordinates as opposed to the shearing boundaries, you don't see the same thing. So this is just something to be careful of if you're using Zeus. But to the actual science, we took this out, took the mean out, and as you can see, we actually get our alpha now to behave itself and to say and continue for a long period of time. So I don't know if you can see it here, but here's what I call the mean, and I calculated a running average. What Steve and I wanted to do was to make sure that this has become a flat line and then we could take off a value of alpha. So to summarise, there are extra cases in here, but these are just doubling the resolution for comparison. The basic resolution, we get alpha of 0.85. As you increase, or as you double the resolution, alpha goes up, and if you double it again, alpha goes up. One point that I'd like to bring to your attention is this calculation took an awfully long time on the J-Cross-B machine that we had in Paris. And we're hitting the... Got a question?
Yeah, your alpha values aren't converted.
It's what it gives. I mean, what Steve and I really wanted to do was have higher values up here, or an actual hard dissipative scale. Obviously, we've just got grid dissipation going on here. The other side of the project, I know I'm going through this rather quickly, but as I say, the details are in the paper. If you increase the box ratio, alpha goes down. But the problem is, I did it at the resolution of the highest one, so it's 128 by 628 grid points by 128. For 1,000 orbits, you're hitting what you can do on most supercomputers. So hopefully there's a few points here that might be of interest to you. First, be careful if you are doing large orbit calculations with a code like Zeus or anything that has the boundary conditions implemented in a similar fashion, you might end up with errors that you're not expecting. There are, as I alluded to, different techniques for removing this error, possibly what Geoffroy Lussier has of shearing, shearing coordinate system is probably the best. But two points that we did get out, obviously, from our very limited data set, we can't actually get a scaling so far. But as alpha increases, as the resolution is increased, so as we decrease the dissipation scale, alpha decreases as we elongated our box, which does tell you that in the smaller box, you're actually restricting the freedom, and basically you're having an impact on the parasitic mode. But as I say, I took this calculation down to the bare bones. I didn't put in any viscosity, any dissipation. I used isothermal equation of state. And even if I continue this further on, oh, that should be cubed. But I reckon the best I could do is probably a 512 cubed calculation for 1,000 orbits. It's 1,000 orbits that kills you. If you only needed to average over 100 orbits, you can do it a lot cheaper. So the point is, how do we get further? And that's where I wanted to leave it over to you. Is there any way, room that we can get further by doing some kind of subgrid scale modeling? Are there other techniques? I'm still fairly new in the MRI world, so I will take all suggestions. No, because of the MOCCT scheme. That's fine.
You check that.
Yeah. It's algorithmic implementation, it forces it.
Not a suggestion, just a dumb question.
That's okay. That's what I started with when I walked into Steve's office, yeah.
Because of the geometry of the disk, you can't have any simplification and just having a 2D model and taking care of the small dimension in other ways.
And these are zero flux simulations, right?
No, these are mean field.
Mean field, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I know Steve has done some calculations in 2D, but I think it's 2D with some small vertical.
And then you don't get the three-dimensional turbulence.
You get
solutions.
Yeah.
Much more laminar, and they tend to produce very large velocities in the end.
Yeah. I guess my closest question is about 2D in the plane of the disk. But you can't do that here because you have a vertical field.
Yes.
So this Gaussian relation for the MRI is k dot d.
Yes.
So you need a kz to get the MRI.
But
so
yeah.
Vertical dimension.
But can't you take just one single mode or something like that?
Well, you
you could.
But the channel flow is just expanding forever. So at some point, this is going to break it.
Okay. Any other questions or suggestions? Besides, we all go get coffee.
Okay, bang on time. Oh, there you go.
Simply, my recommendation is simply to stick with ordinary viscosities and fusibility.
Yes.
And establish for the first time that there's convergence.
Yeah. I mean, this was very much, I was straying into the territory and I've never worked with ideal MHD. I've always used dissipation coefficients, so it was what we could get if we shoot and see how high we can go.
Okay, so we're going to return at 3:45.
I can translate in terms of runtime. The 1,000 orbits on 128 cube ran for 2.5 to 3 months on 32 presses. Yeah. So basically, I got a quarter of our machine at upon the mile and just sat the calculation there for 2.5 months. Yeah. Can't do much better.
Was that understandable?
Yeah, really. I hadn't seen you talking about it before. I knew you had been working on
that. But yeah, it felt very dotty in my head, but that's because I normally overpress.
Yeah, well, it's not really ideal MHP, but do it because you have numerical dissipation.
In terms of the equation,
The equations officially are written that way, but numerically, that's not what you're solving for.
Yeah, I mean, numerically, you do have dissipation.
Yeah, so
I'd rather call it ideal plus root dissipation.
Yeah, it's kind of risky to call that ideal MHT. Well, if you took people who are doing solar surface experiments like kinking stability simulations of flux tubes, they call that ideal MHT, and they don't actually realize that they have good dissipation.
Yeah.
They don't even know it.
If I give it again, I'm
just about nomenclature.
There's another talk after the break.
Yeah, you feel it?
Yeah, I've done the next one.
Okay, yeah, I just want to put the battery in here.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we consider it a problem. We want to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
See? He's even got his title up already.
Sorry?
He's even got his title.
I got home at about 8 and then did a bit of work and then crashed.
Yeah,
I'm
going
to go
back. Oh,
sure.
I can't tell you, but it's you have diffusion, it's just that you don't know what it is. It's a miracle diffusion.
I'm telling you, David.
Yes, I do. I remember that. We sleep a few days.
When you leave, you need a
minute. It depends on the
result.
Oh, gosh. This is going to be hard. I have 20 slides, so. Yeah. Well, some of them are going to be quick, but.
Yeah.
I had 25 minutes.
I could have put the 20 minutes.
Is it all?
I mean, I don't know.
Decretion, yeah.
Yeah, I was trying not to say that.
Well, okay. We might as well start then. So our final talk of the session on the dynamos driven by instabilities by Francois, and he's got his time for that.
So I'm not Gordon Ogilvie, obviously, who was supposed to talk. I mean, he's representative, but all the contents are my responsibility, so maybe we'll disagree with some bits of it, I don't know. So I just want to highlight a few concepts and of what instability-driven dynamos are and how you can relate them to hydrodynamic problems. So I have a lot of gory details, but I'll try to skip some of them and go to the essential stuff. Right. So the first thing I wanted to say is that dynamo is not the only old problem of fluid dynamics. There's another one, which is transition to turbulence in shear flows, which is more than one century old. And this problem hasn't yet been solved, at least not fully. So it dates back from Osborne Reynolds, who's on that picture, who performed these experiments in Hagen and Poiseuille flow, which is a pipe flow. For different Reynolds number, you see some transition appearing, whereas the whole flow originally, you can make a linear stability analysis and show that it's stable linearly, right? So there is transition to turbulence, which is fully nonlinear. And what you observe in these kind of flows, like Hagen-Poiseuille flow or Couette flow, is burst of turbulence and sometimes some cyclical behavior on top of a turbulent background. Right, so I'm going to take here the simple case of plane Couette flow, and here let me introduce some notation. It's going to be incompressible. I define the Reynolds number with respect to the shear, which is triggered between two contra-moving plates. I take this length to define the scale for my Reynolds number and divide by mu to get a Reynolds number. So I'm referring to that as a streamwise direction, right? This is would be the toroidal or zonal direction in astrophysics literature. The shearwise direction would be either radial or latitudinal direction, depending on where you want the shear to be. And this direction here is a spanwise direction, and usually it will be, in a disk, it would be the vertical direction, and in a star, it would be the latitudinal direction, usually. Right, so very simple. You get a shear flow like that, and you want to know what's going on. It's linearly stable. So in the last years, there's been some interesting developments on that problem and how transition takes place in that flow, in these kind of flows. And something called the self-sustaining process has been exhibited in these hydro shear flows. So how does this thing work? If you take the streamwise average equation like m equals zero in a star, you can write the equation of motion for the streamwise velocity and streamwise vorticity this way. And you see that this term here is just a linear term, which is due to the advection of the mean shear by small fluctuations. And this term here is just a nonlinear term related to the nonlinear interactions of non-axis symmetric or streamwise dependent motions. Right, so the first key element in that process is called the lift-up effect. It's something that has been known for a while, and it's just the equivalent of the omega effect for hydro problems. So you get a shear flow that's non-rotating, and what's going on, if you see the little poloidal field, velocity field here, it will turn into a Stokes flow, a strong toroidal velocity field through this kind of equation. So you get transient algebraic growth, and it's only transient because if you cut down all the nonlinear terms, you see that ultimately things will have to decay because they have some spanwise dependence. Right, so that's the first point. This means you can generate a strong toroidal velocity field, axis symmetric, from a weak poloidal velocity field, actually. In units of S times D, this thing has to be 1 over Reynolds number and produces stuff that is order 1 here. So factor Reynolds number amplification. Now, what was the second thing that you want to get a sustained solution just to maintain this small poloidal velocity, to get a nonlinear solution, you first produce these streaks, and then you want them to be unstable. And they're unstable to an instability here, some form of Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, because you have modulated now the shear flow profile by the strong toroidal velocity field that you've been producing. So you get a secondary instability which has a wavelength in that direction. And this thing is going to produce this kind of term, right? And producing this kind of term means you are just going to produce toroidal vorticity or a poloidal velocity field. Right, so if you manage to get that loop to work, then you have some kind of hydrodynamic dynamo, meaning you actually produce toroidal from poloidal instability, produces nonlinear terms feedback on the poloidal velocity field, and everything in principle can be sustained. So how does it work in practice? This thing has built-in nonlinearity, right? Because if you look at the critical Reynolds number for linear instability, once again, it's infinite, whereas you get transition at finite Reynolds number, right? So if you look, for instance, at the curve of, I anticipate the finding of these solutions, but like amplitude of the solution versus Reynolds number, you see that you never get that bifurcation curve to reach zero here. It just asymptote to infinity. So first thing is that it's subcritical. And the second thing is that it's fully non-kinematic in the sense that nonlinear interaction of non-axisymmetric modes are needed straight from the onset. And you also need a finite amplitude perturbation of the poloidal velocity field, which is of order 1 over Reynolds number. It can be small, but it's never infinitesimal, right?
Is this curve suggests that even at infinity, the distance is finite?
No, that's because I just represent the shearing rate. If you look in terms of poloidal velocity field, this thing goes to zero.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is for the toroidal velocity field, which is always produced to be order 1 in that case. Right, so you can compute them. That's just a little poloidal velocity that you put in. To maintain them in the absence of instability, you put a little forcing. And then you produce a strong toroidal velocity field, which on which you can compute the Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, which look like that in a poloidal plane, let's say. And you want to look at how the instability feeds back on these rolls. And so you do that, and you see that as a function of, that's the shearwise coordinate. That would be like the original mode that you put in, and the feedback here as positive correlation in a kind of large zone. So that's potentially, that's been computed for some given aspect ratio of the box, potentially a good candidate just to feedback positively on the poloidal field. And then once you found this solution with forcing, you can attempt to continue it down to zero forcing once and expect that this nonlinear thing is going to take over the forcing that you put initially, right? And once you get to zero forcing, it just turns out that you can do that. You end up with a fully nonlinear solution of the Navier-Stokes equation with no forcing anymore, right? And then you get that point here, a special point on the curve because you've computed stuff for a given Reynolds number. And then you vary the Reynolds number, and by numerical continuation, you can actually sort out a whole bunch of solutions. These ones are called the lower branch, and this one is an upper branch. And so things emerge from a saddle knot bifurcation here. Right, so this way you get basically steady structures, coherent structures which have d over dt equals 0, but which are fully nonlinear. You can play the same kind of game for quasi-flow, either plane or pipe. This is an illustration for pipe flow by Wedin and Kurzweil. You get a bunch of families of solutions This is just a meridional cut in the pipe of what the solutions look like. You have different symmetries. And once again, I want to spot out here that a very important thing is to look at the feedback of the nonlinear, of the secondary instability, the cardinal mass instability that you get on the original polyhedral velocity field. And that's more or less the same plot as before, except now that the radial distance in the pipe. This is the original mode that you put it by forcing. This is what the feedback of the instability looks like. And this way you play the same kind of game by continuing the forcing down to zero and get fully nonlinear solutions, which in that case are traveling waves, nonlinear traveling waves. So nonlinear feedback must be tuned very carefully to get this self-sustained solution. Right, so now we'd like to know what are the time dynamics. This is all a coherent structures point of view. So we want to know what's in real life when you have a time evolution, how things work. So we need to understand the role of these structures in the phase space of the corresponding dynamical system. So let's imagine you have your laminar flow here in phase space. That's just a solution with pure shear. And you get your lower branch solution here. It's somewhere like in the plane with toroidal energy and polyhedral energy. You can represent it in many different ways. And you could see that this fixed point has attracting directions and has repelling directions. It has a stable manifold and an unstable one. So what's going on, in at least in the case of Plain-Couette flow, is you want to understand the role of the lower branch in triggering the transition to turbulence. And what you see, if you start from... that's a recent paper that's going to appear in JFM. If you start from slight perturbation to the laminar flow, most of the time you go close to the lower branch in some... here they have a strange representation of these structures, which is not straightforward. Let's just imagine that you take a two-dimensional cut of the phase space and look at how things work in that plane. So you go most of the time close to the lower branch and you get attracted, then it goes into the repelling direction and gets attracted to either the lower branch or yet another solution that has been found recently. So that's a whole bunch of... if you start from a random trajectory, you can get a whole sorts of dynamics that are actually kind of constrained by the presence of these fixed points or periodic orbits. So for Plain-Couette flow, things are very, very simple in the sense that the lower branch fixed point is very important, meaning that you only need a very, very perturbation, 1/RE perturbation of a polyhedral velocity field. Immediately, because of the shear, you will obtain a strong toroidal velocity that will make you become closer to the lower branch, but you will only approach the lower branch once the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability gets triggered. And then, since you will not be perfectly coming to that fixed point, because there's no reason why originally your initial set of condition is just in the plane of the in the stable manifold of the fixed point, at some point you will just be kicked away because these solutions have one unstable eigenvalue, so they become unstable to other things and go either to a turbulent basin or yet another solution. So the prediction for Couette flow is that transition is triggered by order 1/RE perturbations of polyhedral velocity. The Poiseuille flow is more complex, and I thought I would talk briefly about this problem, because unlike Plain-Couette flow, where the delimitation between the transition is done by the stable manifold of the fixed point, in the case of Poiseuille flow, where you get less symmetries, you have traveling waves. And in pipe Poiseuille flow, it also turns out that there is a strange attractor, which you cannot compute exactly, but there are techniques just to approach it. So what I'm showing here is, instead of having a kind of curve which would go like that for Plain-Couette flow, like 1/RE, here Schneider and Eckhart have been computing what they call the edge of chaos, which separates trajectories in phase space that decay to zero, to the laminar flow, from those that become turbulent. And you can use shooting method to do that by refining initial conditions just to stay for as long as you want on this edge state, right, which contains a chaotic attractor which has a stable manifold. And then here you are just circulating on it. And if you just kick this thing a little bit, you either become turbulent and get back to the laminar thing. So whereas in Couette flow, this thing would have been a straight line because you just get to the fixed point, which is a steady state. Here you just seem to circulate between some weird structure, which is actually a strange attractor. You can actually make Poincaré sections of these trajectories and see that it behaves like a strange attractor. So in this respect, this gives you this kind of funny shape for the transition curve, And the scaling of the critical amplitude, even though it kind of globally evolved like 1 over RE, has all these sorts of deformations, which actually make it difficult the precise threshold for the amplitude that you need for the transition. And that's actually a problem for engineers who want to control and delay the transition to turbulence, because they like to know which kind of noise they can afford in the system.
Is this the same as it having a riddle basin of attraction, or is that a bit of a strange attractor?
Well, this thing as a whole, it's a projection, it's a 2D projection of the fully dynamical system. And this thing has a stable manifold which has a lot of dimensions. And it has, again, one stable eigenvalue. So there's no reason for original set of boundary of initial condition that you're exactly on that stable manifold and then you won't stay on it, so you're going to get kicked away at some point. Yeah. So, how does this relate to MHG? So, if you now take the problem of instability-driven dynamos, what we get is this induction equation in the presence of shear, and well, you don't get the lift-up effect in that case. You could get it in the momentum equation, but what you get in here, the most important thing is that you get the omega effect, which is, produces strong toroidal magnetic field from weak poloidal velocity magnetic field, sorry. And in terms of Alvin speed and scaling everything by S times D again, it turns out that you can generate transiently, once again, axisymmetric toroidal field of order 1 from a very weak order 1 over RM poloidal field. But this is, once again, only a transient effect, because in the absence of instability or non-axisymmetry x-independent motions, you end up by diffusing everything resistively, right? So 3D nonlinear feedback is required to sustain the poloidal field, so it's just Colling's theorem. And in that case, it just requires you consider the non-axisymmetric MHG instabilities which are related to the presence of the toroidal fields that you've been creating by the omega effect. And I'd like to mention that there were some preliminary first 2.5D models of the importance of these things for the geodynamos in the 80s and 90s. Chris Jones has been part of that, and which way kind of very much into that kind of spirit. So first example that I'm going to give is a constructive example. It's a case of MRI. I haven't shown the momentum equation, but just imagine that you get Keplerian shear, meaning global rotation plus some pure shear with a ratio that is the Keplerian ratio. What you'd like to know is, in the absence of mean field, can you actually have an MRI dynamo with something that would average to zero overall if you average over the box, but still has non-zero RMS value. And then you can play the same kind of game as you were playing for the hydro problem and get inspired by what you were doing. So instead of putting a forcing in the momentum equation here, I'm going to put a little EMF that's going to force a very weak poloidal magnetic field. Now I have the omega effect, which is going to stretch my field into a toroidal field, which is done on the color plot here, plus and minus. And this toroidal field, because the MRI has this dispersion relation B dot K, is going to be unstable to an MRI that has non-zero M, or non-zero streamwise dependence, if you want. So that's great, because non-zero streamwise dependence means you can get feedback on the axisymmetric field. Right, so you can play the same kind of game of continuation with respect to the forcing. Look at the feedback. So first you get these instabilities, which look like this. And I'm going to the details of that, just to let you know that they produce some V prime cross B prime, which you can monitor. And that's as a function of the shearwise direction on the fundamental mode of the rolls. The feedback produced, and this was the original forcing that was putting. So once again, you get a very good correlation, which allows you for the nonlinear interactions produced by the MRI toroidal instability to take over the forcing. So some modes have a good feedback, and if you play the same kind of game, reduce the forcing progressively, nonlinear interactions take over, and you finally get a fully nonlinear solutions of all the equations. And once again, so the bifurcation is going to be subcritical, because here there's no steady background on which you could linearize, basically just to get the MRI, since you want a toroidal MRI. So no real critical Reynolds number, and you need J cross B, because the MRI requires J cross B straight from the onset. So it's a fully non-kinematic case again. And so what does this solution look like? If you go to RM infinity, you get the same kind of asymptote for the location of the lower branch. So it's the same kind of subcritical behavior as you had in the hydro case. This is a solution in the streamwise, shearwise plane, nonlinear solution. And so once again, the only thing you need originally is a small but finite poloidal magnetic field of order 1 over Rm to produce this kind of solution, which in that case is a steady one. Next week, Geoffroy Lesurs will give a talk at the conference on dynamo cycles made on the same kind of principles and which kind of extends that work by a big amount and make it far more interesting for real accretion disks. But the basic principles are just here. So another example of that, I thought, well, maybe this kind of concept of applying these things of that you have in the shear flow community to the dynamo community is useful. And I remembered seeing Nick showing this dynamo like 2 or 3 years ago, I don't remember. And there was this thing, I remember something with shear and non-axisymmetric instabilities. I said, oh, there's something interesting in there. So if you look at this, I'm not going to talk about these simulations in detail because, I mean, it's already been doing that in a lot of details previously. Just to point out that you get these non-axisymmetric instabilities, you get shear, so all the ingredients are here. What's happening in this case, I think, is if you have a small it's non-rotating, so if you have a small velocity perturbation, you are going to poloidal velocity perturbation, you are going to create a strong toroidal velocity field by the lift-up effect, right, which is going to change basically your background shear flow. And to produce this small poloidal velocity field, as he told you, what he has is the magnetic buoyancy instabilities, right? So what's going on here, you have the shear-produced toroidal field, which induces a small poloidal flow, which through the lift-up effect produces strong toroidal velocity field. Strong toroidal velocity field with inflection points, mean Kelvin, Helmholtz, these things kind of twist the magnetic buoyancy structure, the magnetically buoyant structure, produce V cross B, and feedback on the small poloidal magnetic field. So therefore you get a dynamo. And they clearly note in the paper that they need finite amplitude B. So my guess here, even though I'm not sure, is that if you, again, think in terms of things dimensionalized in terms of the shear velocity S times D, you would get an Alvin speed for you would need a poloidal Alvin speed of order 1 over Rm if things turn out to behave a little bit like what's going on for either for the MRI or for plane quate flow. It could be more complicated because since they have this kind of sawtooth profile, they don't have the symmetries of plane quate flow or anything like that. So maybe since you also see these kind of structures here, which look pretty much chaotic, it could be that you have an edge of chaos in that problem, and therefore the transition might not be strictly order 1 over Rm, but you could have modulations of that. I don't know about that. I just want to point out that it's probably interesting to look at these problems in terms of how people analyze shear flows. Another point that I'd like to make here is that, according to me, I'm not sure this is true, but if you go to a strongly rotating regime, this kind of dynamo should disappear because in that case you don't get any more the triggering by the lift-up effect of the strong velocity structure because you get epicyclic motion instead. And therefore, if you don't get strong toroidal velocity field, you don't get the finite amplitude velocity field that has inflection points, and you don't get the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability anymore, and therefore you don't get the secondary instabilities, and therefore you don't get the feedback anymore. So it'd be interesting to test. It's probably going to work in a weakly rotating regime. If you look at the transition in plate quate flow, you can extend it to a weakly rotating regime, but it's more and more difficult as far as rotation is increased to get it. Yet, another more speculation, again, I'm sad Sasha is not here. If you now consider the Sprott dynamos he's been talking about, maybe you remember he had these structures here with a localized shear. He was putting a big poloidal field here. So in that region, you get strong toroidal magnetic field that is induced. You get this MHD instability, the Pitts-Taylor instability. And obviously, if the toroidal field is there, then as you see here, the M equals 1 component, the non-axisymmetric instability is going to be localized in that area, whereas the poloidal field was just put in there. So obviously, there's not a good overlap between the feedback and the poloidal fields that you were putting initially. So to me, it's not that surprising that they don't get a dynamo, because maybe it's a matter of how the EMF is localized, the feedback can be localized. And yeah, so the last problem I want to talk about, Mark Misch is not here either, I think he's left, is the one that Mark has been working on and which also shares all these characteristics. In that case, you get latitudinal shear and these global non-axisymmetric instabilities. Seems to get some cycles when you put some weak poloidal magnetic field in the problem. So maybe this kind of analysis and perspective in the problem is also useful for these kind of things. Last thing I wanted to say is how does this relate to mean field theory? Well, that's a plot from Nick's 2003 paper, and obviously it's clear that you cannot put the feedback, the EMF, in terms of constant times mean field or axisymmetric field. It doesn't fit very well. I think Geoffroy will tell more about that for the MRI problem during his talk, how you can relate it to the mean field problem. My big issue is actually trying to apply the mean field idea to these things and make some form of average theories of that, is that you lose all the subcriticality aspects, because suddenly when you linearize the EMF, what's going on? You have a linear bifurcation suddenly that you didn't have before, and the built-in nonlinearity is completely lost. So is this important? If you look at the phase space dynamic in hydro shear flows, you just see that all this thing with transient dynamics and going around coherent structures plays a major role in kicking the whole turbulent dynamics of the system. So it's not clear that you can actually capture that with 2D mean field dynamo models, and that you can parameterize this kind of instability-driven dynamos that easily. So I would suggest that new directions for instability-driven dynamos, which might be chaotic, we might gain some information by following the trajectory of people working in the transition communities that have been making huge progress in the last 10 years on understanding the subcritical transition in shear flows. And that's all.
Some questions.
go on.
Does all these studies of transition, do they really tell us more about how the turbulent state operates? Do they go any way to answer it?
Well, one important thing that they seem to show is actually turbulence doesn't have an infinite lifetime. For instance, if you take the case of quasi flow, you have this edge of chaos, and on the right side you had all these turbulent trajectories, which all more or less ultimately decay to the laminar state with different timescales. But they kind of seem to show that even this nonlinear dynamics is overall some form of transient effect. So that's the first point that might be learned in that case. And then the second point is all this cyclical behavior or chaotic behavior very much depends on the symmetries of the problems. And of course, a lot of work has been done on chaotic behavior in mean field dynamos. But here we are really talking about the real 3D MHD equations, right? And we can really capture all this form of funky dynamics by making these kind of models. So.
Any other comments? And I have a comment. And a simple model of shear flow instability is if you have a look at the complex Ginzburg-Landau equation with through flow, and there you can get transient dynamics and, in fact, very similar kind of, I've forgotten what you call it, local
edge of chaos, yeah. Chaos. No.
As you decay towards a flat solution.
Yeah, well, edge of chaos is not something specific to that problem. It's an old concept from the 60s or 70s, I don't remember. And actually, the first papers that Eckhard wrote were for a kind of simplified dynamical system with only nine variables.
Right.
So I'm not surprised that you can get these kind of things with, well, I mean, even the Lorentz attractor, you just have three variables, right? So it's you have here you have something which is complicated because you have 3D structures and you need to resolve many modes, but overall the phenomenology of it is kind of simple nonlinear dynamics. Yes.
Yeah. So that in that problem it's 1D, so you can find all the unstable states very easily.
Yeah. Well, that's a point that one could make, is that in that limit here of infinite Reynolds Mendick Reynolds number, you just need a very, very small feedback, because the feedback just needs to compensate for the 1 over Rm Laplacian of bipoloidal term. So in that limit, you only need one mode in the toroidal direction. The feedback provided by one mode, this 2.5D model that Chris has been developing, is actually what represents what's going on here on this lower branch. So it's possible kind of to reduce the problem to a 2.5D model somehow in that limit, but you won't capture the whole thing, of course.
No. Okay, let's thank Francois again.